Welcome to Cultimatum, the podcast uncovering the dark realities of cults and human trafficking. I'm your host, Anonymous Andrew, and each week we dive deep into the manipulation, control, and courageous escapes that define these worlds.
And I'm Melody, Andrew's co-host. Having experienced the depth of a cult firsthand, specifically the House of Yahweh, I am here as an advocate for fellow survivors.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests are their own and do not reflect the official policy or position of Cultimatum or its affiliates. The content discussed on this podcast are based on personal experiences and should not be construed as factual or legal advice. Neither the host nor the guest are liable for any statements made during the episodes. Listeners are encouraged to conduct their own research and seek professional advice where appropriate.
And before we dive into today's episode, we want to issue a trigger warning. Some episodes may cover explicit and potentially disturbing subjects such as sexual abuse, rape, human trafficking, suicide, and other sensitive subjects. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Cultimatum Podcast, the culture of cults and human trafficking. And my name is Anonymous Andrew, and with me today is my co-host Melody. Hello, Melody.
Hi, Andrew. We are honored to welcome Violet to the show today. She's a powerful voice in the survivor community and a prominent content creator with a large following on TikTok. Violet bravely shares her journey of growing up in what she refers to as a death cult, only later to find herself an evangelical Christian cult during her childhood. Her story doesn't end there. No. Violet is also a survivor of human trafficking. So through her candid storytelling and advocacy work, she will shed light upon these complex worlds. Violet, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yes, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
She hits all her buttons, doesn't she?
Yeah. Two cults and a human trafficking story. So
I know. I'm a glutton for punishment. What can I say?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
All right. It's all yours.
All right. Well, so I want to start out by saying the original death cult I was in, it didn't start getting really super scary, like very violent and militant until I was probably, I want to say about 11, but we started being active religiously when I was probably about 6 or 7. And we just kind of escalated at a certain point, and then things got really crazy. As far as the timeline for the human trafficking went, that started, I'm not sure, probably when I was around a toddler, and it stopped weirdly around the same time that the violent OG cult started to really take off. So I think the timeline set up for that was very interesting. The original, you know, death cult that I was in was almost certainly, at least from the trafficker's perspective, mostly set up to control and silence the victims because he was very concerned about us starting to say something. So he decided to terrorize us.
Okay, before we get into that, and only because I'm one of the people that don't, I'm not a cult survivor. What is a death cult?
Well, I actually don't know exactly what the specific definition is as far as like the dictionary goes, but I can say that we glorified violence and death very much. We were very obsessed with the concept of being hunted or having to kill in order to survive and keep our group safe. So it wasn't a death cult in the sense of we were talking about doing a Jonestown or a Branch Davidian situation. There wasn't like a self-destructive aspect to it. It was more of a other people will hunt us and it will be glorious and we will have to fight back and it will be glorious and there will be death involved, but it will be a wonderful thing.
Would you say it was like a survivalist type of atmosphere?
Yeah, very much so. Something really interesting that I've started realizing as I read more stories from survivors of similar groups is that we actually had a lot of similarities to certain Mormon groups or some of the groups that are the extreme high controlling polygamous groups, not necessarily the mainstream Mormon church. But there are a lot of like really interesting similarities there. The like fixation with avoiding government documents and things like that. But yeah, very survivalist oriented. We never had a bunker or anything like that, but we did have weapons and we were pretty obsessed with those.
So you lived off the grid, maybe, kind of?
No, we never really quite got to that point. It was a very small group, so we didn't have a lot of set structure. It was basically my family and one other family. So the other family had a farm that they owned, so we would spend a lot of time there. Most of the strange things that happened were there. So we were never off the grid, but we did spend, I want to say like a week out of every year, maybe more, learning to camp off the grid on their property and learning like survivalism stuff, weird things like that.
Okay, so kind of militant based.
Yeah, we kind of were like a militia, but again, very tiny. And the group was mostly children. There were four adults altogether. So there wasn't a lot of like grown people running around with weapons. It was,
right,
you know, mostly one or two of the more extreme adults trying to teach the children how to do violence.
So I gather you were firing weapons at the age of 5 and 6.
No, actually, I wasn't. So that only really started escalating again when I was probably around 11. Because I am female, that wasn't really like, I wasn't completely prevented from doing any kind of weapons training, but I was discouraged from it heavily. So I didn't really do a whole lot of that, but I started at some point when I realized that my fate was either to make myself useful combat-wise or to become, in all effects and purposes, a breeder. I decided that I was going to make myself indispensable combat-wise because I didn't want that.
Okay, a difficult question here. Where does the human trafficking fit in? So there's two families, four adults, lots of children. The children were trafficked?
Not the children in the other family, as far as I'm aware. Actually, this other family didn't realize that this was happening. The trafficking happened mostly before our group became super active, at least for me. There were other children in my family that were harmed in this world, but I'm not really going to share a lot about their personal stories. But I can say for me personally, what I dealt with was mostly before the cult really took off and got crazy. So there definitely was connections between it. But I honestly think that my main trafficker, my father, he mostly was interested in running the cult, again, just to kind of have a lot of control over his victims and keep us quiet.
I'm sorry to ask you this. Because I'm not quite on, I just want to make sure I understand. Your father sold you for sex? Okay.
Yeah. So it actually, it's really interesting. It's fascinating. He didn't do that very often, and there wasn't really monetary exchange, which I never could really understand, because after I, you know, we left the death cult and I joined like this evangelical situation, you know, and they kind of like to showcase and talk a lot about human trafficking, like it's, you know, a big scary thing, but they get really into like the more extreme rare examples because they're really flashy and showy. So when I was hearing all these stories about how human trafficking works and everything, it didn't make sense with what had happened to me before. So that was really, really baffling to me. But yeah, there wasn't ever exchange of money that I saw. I did see money exchanged once, but it was, in my opinion, it was more of a fetish for the, I don't know what you'd call that person, the John in that situation. Like, he just like liked the concept of that being part of the interaction. But overall, all of the times that I was trafficked, I never saw exchange of money. What I believe was happening was that these situations were almost always filmed. And I believe that my trafficker wanted access to films. And the way the trafficking world usually works is that if you want access to films of, you know, child abuse, you need to provide some. There's like a trading system. It's how they filter out police and they filter out vigilante people, you know, stuff like that. So I think that a lot of what was going on is that he just needed films of people assaulting me so he could exchange them.
Yeah. It's like a drug dealer wants you to do a line of coke before he, you know, to make sure you're not a cop. So
yeah.
It's kind of, yeah.
He wasn't, he wasn't in the room a lot of the times when I was assaulted. He would just kind of like leave me and let people take me off somewhere else. And he'd hang out in the garage. And he actually did seem kind of disturbed a couple times after that happened, because I was pretty badly, beaten during this particular situation. But he seemed a little disturbed by it. Not that I'm saying that, you know, we should feel sorry for him whatsoever, but he wasn't, you know, he wasn't
comfortable.
Yeah, he wasn't comfortable, but he still
did it.
That film. He still needed that film. So he still kept doing that.
Your mom, was she aware of this?
I don't think that she acknowledged it. It's their situation is very interesting because he met her when she was 15 and he's 10 years older than her. So when they got into a relationship, she was still a child. She had come from a very abusive home life herself. And because he didn't ever raise a hand to her or strike her, she thought that he was, you know, basically God on earth. He was amazing. He was wonderful.
Of course. Yeah.
So when they started getting into a lot of the like extremely conservative style religious beliefs, a lot of the fundamentalism, the extreme submission of women to their husbands, it's hard to explain how much of a mind twisting happens there, but she basically, if he said something didn't happen, she would convince herself it didn't happen. Not making excuses for her either, because she definitely saw things and chose to ignore it. But she was also very saturated in that culture.
Yeah, that's a very cult mentality. That's very typical. Cult members will do that. You know, if the leader does something that causes cognitive dissonance and they are gaslit by the leader, they tend to just believe whatever the leader says because that aligns with what their thinking is and the brainwashing that goes on. So I can certainly understand that mentality, because when you're in that situation, you accept things that normally would be the unacceptable.
Yeah, there's one particular story that I think really shows this dynamic fully between my parents. When I was about 6, my father had me and one of my siblings kneel on raw rice on a tile floor. And his explanation was that the Great Tribulation was going to happen soon, and we needed to prove how strong we were and that we would be able to hold up to torture from the One World Government. So he was, you know, testing us. He did a lot of weird tests like that. But this one was particularly rough. You know, when you kneel on raw rice on tile, the rice grains will cut into your leg and they will get stuck underneath your skin. They'll push up under the skin. So there was like blood. We're kneeling there and all that. Like it's a bad scene. And then afterwards, my sibling had some rice stuck underneath their skin and we couldn't get it out. So he's there with tweezers trying to pull the rice out from their knees. And my mother was watching and she started to cry. And she was like, this is too much. This is too much. You know, this isn't okay. This isn't okay. It's too much for them. And my dad put down the tweezers. He gets up and he puts his arm around her and he says, listen, this is just too much for you to see because you're a mother. You have a mother's soft heart. You can't see this. It is too much for you. And he just like gently leads her out of the room, puts her into the bedroom, shuts the door. We can hear her crying in there. And then he just comes back out and keeps pulling rice out of my sibling's leg. Like it was a very interesting, like the right thing for her to do, obviously, in that situation would have been to call the police, scream, run, you know, something. But, you know, again, like you see that really interesting gray area, the interplay between the victim and the enabler slash abuser scenario that happens.
This was all done to practice, to get you prepped in case you were captured and tortured so you would know what pain felt like.
Yeah, because the whole thing was that at some point they are going to get us. It was told to us pretty regularly. They will torture you in front of us to make us deny Christ. You know, we're going to do everything we can to hide and prevent that from happening. But there is a good chance it will happen. And you should really try not to scream too much when that happens, because it'll be kind of hard for me to see. was kind of the, like, that's something that my father said specifically a couple times. Like, that's going to be hard to see.
That is so disturbing. Because let's say the federal government did raid you, which we know all the stories of them doing. They're not going to torture a child.
No, they're not. It's ridiculous.
But you didn't know that at 6 years old.
No, I was just like, oh shit, it's happening. You know, I was very scared. I saw a cop car and I was panicking in my chair. You know, he had this interesting kind of, because our belief system is, it was called Messianic Judaism. There's a lot of aspects of Orthodox Judaism and a lot of aspects of Pentecostal Christianity kind of rolled into one thing. But according to my dad, I have no idea how this actually stacks up against Orthodox Judaism beliefs. You are not considered an adult and like fully cognizant and aware of your sins until a female turns 12 and a male turns 13. So his explanation was that when we get caught and tortured, as long as I was under 12 years old, it didn't matter if I denied Christ because I was a child and like, God knows my heart, you know, he'll understand. I'm just a kid. I don't fully understand salvation. Once I pass that birthday, then it's a problem. So that's kind of why there was a lot of a focus on not necessarily me being tortured to deny my faith, but to make the adults deny their faith.
Wow.
Just a weird situation.
There is definitely some weird dynamics there. And I'm just going to speak in your mom's defense that certainly there are some dynamics there where it sounds to me like she was almost in some ways trafficked and groomed. If she got married when she was 15, that's quite young. And I'm sure that she was almost conditioned to behave and react in the way that she did. Does that make sense?
No, I 100% agree. They didn't marry when she was 15. They met when she was 15, but they were together since then. So he still, regardless of whether they signed a document or not, he had that control over her as a partner. So yeah, I gave my mom a lot of flack for what happened because while it never invalidated the pain or, you know, took away from the fact that she didn't protect me, I also am able to understand how brainwashing works and how she really was groomed, like you said, since she was a child. Right. You know, I was a religious extremist. I was, you know, pretty close to becoming a domestic terrorist at one point. I understand how it gets into your head. So I definitely agree with you on that one.
So where did the switch go when you went from the death cult to the evangelical Christian cult?
Oh God. So that is a really, really fun story. So basically this death cult starts taking off. It starts activating. It starts getting really scary. My father's father died. My grandpa passed away. And I think that my father had some kind of a mental breakdown. He started having panic attacks. He started having these weird episodes where he'd be very hyper. It turns out later that he has bipolar. And it seems that the passing of his father might have triggered a manic episode. So he started having these episodes happening. And he started kind of, that's when like things in the cult started getting really scary and violent because he was like getting like all the paranoia and the delusions of grandeur sometimes. So he starts activating like crazy and he takes a strong interest in my best friend at the time, who is the children of this other family in this group. And he starts to groom her over several years. And I won't get into all the details because this, it would take like 3 hours to explain everything. It would be super complicated. But long story short, he's grooming her. He ends up trying to kidnap her at one point. He convinces her, he isolates her, tells her that her dad is abusive and neglectful and that he's going to save her. And he gets caught with this plan. And there's a whole blow up in the group. So the group kind of disbands and he freaks out and he's having a whole thing. And he starts getting like close to violent in the home openly, because before the violence was like kind of behind closed doors. Now it's like he's running around in the front yard acting like a maniac. So my mom goes through his devices. She finds a bunch of pornography on it. And apparently that is the breaking point. And she was like, he's cheating on me with porn. So they split up. They separated. And they basically were like, oh, we're going to get counseling and get back together, but we need to separate right now because, you know, my mom just was so hurt about it. And then as victims tend to do, when the abuser is taken out of their situation and they're not in their face holding them under their thumb all the time, they'll start talking. And next thing you know, the victims started talking. People started saying things. People went to the police. And from there, you know, it was all game over. And my mom was like, we are never going back. When she left my dad, she ended up joining this church, this home church situation in a town, like an hour away from our home. And this group is the one that was an offshoot of the International House of Prayer. And they were more of your run-of-the-mill kind of evangelical latte Jesus, super spiritual kind of situation. So that's how we kind of made the transition from that death cult to the evangelical situation.
What year are we talking?
At this point, I believe it was 2013, 2014 when that happened. It was like the December of 2013.
So the death cult and you being trafficked was around in the early 2000s or mid-2000s. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So a question. Did at the time that you're now in the International House of Prayer and associated with that, does your dad come back into the picture and he is also part of that group, or do your parents not get back together after that?
They did not get back together. We had restraining orders, actually. And he didn't show any kind of an interest in trying to really, you know, loudly proclaim his innocence and try to get back into our lives. I think he kind of understood that his smartest move would to be just to back off and go quiet and stay away. So pretty much once the police report started getting filed, once the restraining orders happened, he just completely disappeared. He didn't like go missing. He just did not attempt to interact or see anybody.
So he was reported trafficking you. In other words,
he was. There were police reports. There were investigations. He had his all of his devices taken at some point by the police to go through them to find evidence. You know, I'm not really sure what went on there, but I do know that he was very obsessed with like separate hard drives and things like that. That was a huge thing, you know, when the cult was really active, was covering your tracks online and just stuff like that. So I don't really know the details of what happened when they specifically went through his tech, but I suspect that they didn't find anything because I didn't hear anything about additional charges being filed or things being found.
Okay, so I might be jumping a little ahead of the gun here, but do you know where he is today?
Oh, yeah, I know where he is. I know the street he lives on. He actually tried to get in touch with me a few months ago.
Is there a statute of limitations in the state you're in? Or that state that this occurred in?
No. So I could try to go back and push for the case to be, you know, reopened and stuff, but unfortunately, it was pretty badly contaminated, so I don't really know how well that would go for me. It's kind of a shame. I also live thousands of miles away. I got married at 20 years old, and I cut and run. I didn't stick around.
Okay. So what was your experience in the evangelical cult? What was that cult or that group like as far as their teachings? Because I've never heard of that one, so I don't know a whole lot about that group.
Well, they were extremely Pentecostal. They were very into the concept of demonic possession, oppression, spiritual warfare, dreams, visions, very, very much of that woo-woo kind of version of Christianity. And they didn't have it, they weren't Baptist. And that's the thing, is there were a lot of similarities with like the extreme purity culture. Because it was a home church situation, there were different denominations of people that would filter in and out. So you would have people that were wearing sleeves down to their wrists, head coverings. You had other people that thought it was okay to wear shorts as long as they touched the top of your knee. You know, it wasn't a large, very set group again, but they were an offshoot of the International House of Prayer. Some of the people had been staff members there. So a lot of very, very fundamentalist beliefs, very similar to the IBLP, but again, with a lot more Pentecostal beliefs. That was really hard for me because I had never really encountered like larger groups of Christians because our cult was so small and we were so theologically different. We never really bonded or interacted with mainstream Christians. So this was the first time I'd done that. I was really excited because they seemed really nice, really cool. They seemed very sweet and friendly. People were very kind. But then the other shoe kind of dropped. And, you know, then it was like, oh, wow, they actually are treating you really bad because you're not a virgin. And, you know, they're worried that you might have demons because some of these people very strongly believe that you can be possessed by a demon through sexual assault. So as somebody who's been human trafficked, you know, they were very wary of me. They were very concerned about that. And it was very hard. I felt very much like a bit of a black sheep because I was the only one in my family that really...
Oh, how did they know about that?
Well, my mother decided to talk about it.
Oh, geez.
Hence the contamination of my criminal case. I'm not diagnosing. I'm not saying I know this or that. She has a lot of traits that are similar to what you'd see in a narcissist. So in this situation where there's a lot of lack of control and instability, there was a great deal of like dramatically throwing oneself to the floor and weeping at the loss of their, you know, their family and their beautiful life. Like very, I'm sad, come save me kind of things happening. So when you're kind of in that mode, it's like, I will tell details about my children's abuse because I want people to
feel bad.
Yeah. Which like, I understand again, you're in pain, you're processing, but also our case got kind of messed up.
But, and she over dramatized it. Like,
I mean, it's really, it's very back and forth, honestly, because on one hand, she would like have this huge like pity party scenarios where like my child was abused, this happened, that happened. But then if I said anything about it, if I ever made mention or acknowledged that I had been abused, she would say that she didn't remember any of it. And it was just very strange.
It is.
To have control of the narrative is the conclusion I eventually came to. It was okay if she talked about it, but she didn't want me to talk about it.
Mm. Almost like she almost used it as a way of getting attention for herself.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
Kind of. What
I mean, she didn't just get attention. She got free housing for a year from somebody. She got a lot of people were giving her money and food.
Oh, so she played off it.
Yeah, she actually like didn't work for, I want to say, a year or two after we left my dad because we did have some savings. But she also was just kind of, you know, it was a pitiful sight. You know, this woman who'd been married for 25 years, she has seven young children, and she's scared. She's alone. You know, people felt really bad.
So you have six brothers and sisters.
Yes.
Wow.
Six of them. So yeah, it was a very pitiful sight. I understand why people felt sorry.
I feel sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a sorry situation.
And not even sorry. I feel revolted, like disgusted.
Yeah. It was a rough time of it because, you know, she was pretty comfortable taking a lot of these handouts and getting all of this attention and stuff. I was horribly embarrassed because, again, like I'm born into a damn cult where I'm learning how to shoot and stuff like that. So like I'm sitting here now where there's like soft music and people who do foot washing ceremonies and all these like little ladies with lavender oil. And they're like, we're so sorry, sweetheart. And, you know, we just want to give you stuff and take care of your mom. And I'm like, what is this? I was so confused.
So were you, this sounds like love bombing.
It was extremely love bomby. Okay. It was. It really was. Because like they started being extremely like sweet, sweet, nice, nice. And then suddenly there was like, Your children have to throw away their DVDs that have worldly music in them. Your children can't wear this. Your children need to throw away their playing cards because it looks like gambling. So, like, just fun things like that.
Normal things that the rest of us, like, a deck of playing cards. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I caught a lot of flack for it too because I like black nail polish and I had a trench coat and, you know, that was apparently a very large problem for people.
A trench coat?
Yeah, it was. Somebody gave it to me in Massachusetts. It was a like a Hot Topic kind of thing. It was like a corset goth coat and it was really pretty. I loved it. And I came home with it from when I went to Massachusetts and my mom was cool with it. This was 2 days before she left my dad. I came home with this coat. 2 days later, we leave and we go to this weird little evangelical community. And my first 2 weeks there, somebody was already calling leadership in a conniption fit because they saw me walking outside wearing it. And they thought that I was being influenced by witchcraft. And it was like a whole problem.
Where would they get that idea? Because of the coat?
I don't really know what their reasoning was. They had a very set idea of what a young woman should look like. It was very, you know, long flowing hair, gentle, more, you know, like traditionally feminine.
Feminine. Yeah.
And the coat, while it had like a long coat skirt to it, it was very goth and, you know, extra bad points because I got it in Massachusetts close to Salem. So they thought I bought it from witches or that witches gave it to me. It looked gothic. It looked wrong. There wasn't like any specific thing that I was told besides, oh, sweetie, you really shouldn't have that. That looks bad.
And you did what about it? Did you continue wearing it?
No, I was humiliated. I was really embarrassed. I didn't throw it away at first. I hung it up in a closet. And I did pray over it a lot because at that point, like everybody was telling me that it was demonic and I had been raised in that kind of an environment. I thought maybe it was, you know, I was second guessing myself. I felt stupid. So I did like a little deliverance prayer over this coat. And I eventually got rid of it. But yeah, I completely went along with what they said I should do because I was concerned. I thought I was doing something wrong. I thought I was in danger.
Well, rightfully so, because you were in a cult that was love bombing you and they were calling you a witch.
Were calling me a witch.
So what age were you at this point?
At that point, I was 17.
Okay. And so you and your mom and your six siblings are living in a house?
We're all in a church lady's house, one of the leadership for this group.
Okay.
We're like in the eye of the hurricane there.
Okay. Any specifics about this cult? Because in the beginning, these cults love bomb you. They make you feel welcome and with everything you just described. But at some point, did things start to take a turn?
Yeah. So it was very unfortunate for me. But with all of the things that were happening, my mom started to kind of, I think she was having a little bit of a crisis, which is fully understandable. And she was upset about everything. She kind of started fixating on me as being a problem, you know, because I embarrassed her the first week there with that stupid coat. And I always have kind of gone head to head with her on things. So I've never really been a favorite of hers. She's apparently told people that she could sense spiritual darkness in me since I was 5. So she starts fixating on me as a problem. And there was a situation where an old man tried to court me and she got angry at me when I didn't go along with it. And then I had a suicide attempt and she told people that I was doing it for attention. So at that point, I knew I had to survive. So I went to somebody else in leadership in that church and I asked if I could stay with them for a few days to get my head on straight. And this person, who is a very frightening person, they call themselves a Christian therapist. They were giving my family therapy. They don't have actual licenses or anything like that.
Of course not.
This woman really liked me. And she was like, oh, of course, you can come stay with me for a bit. And then from there, I basically left my mom's house and started staying with her and refusing to go home to my mom. So this lady and my mom start fighting about it a lot. Long story short, this woman is defending me and protecting me. And I'm feeling, you know, I don't trust her a lot, but I feel like somebody finally has my back. And then she starts using me for free labor. And I made like $5 and $15 a week for a whole year. So not quite free. She starts using me for labor and she starts taking me around the community and having me trying to get me to share my story about being trafficked to these really weird little evangelical groups. And I didn't want to do it and I didn't do it, but she kept guilt tripping me about it. She started kind of using me to like boost her social status as a savior. She reminds me a lot of that woman, Jody Hildebrandt.
I should know who that is, but I don't think
me too.
It's not ringing a specific bell. Is that somebody from another
country? It sounds familiar.
So she ran a really popular mommy vlog channel on YouTube called, I think it was 8 Passengers. She was that Mormon mommy vlogger that was in the news recently because her children escaped from her home with like ligatures on them and they were severely underweight. They had been tortured.
Okay.
And it turns out she had gotten involved. Yeah. Jody Hildebrandt is the therapist that she got involved with that basically took over her life and ran it. So when that was an interesting story for me to hear and read the court documents and stuff about, because this woman and Jody Hildebrandt had a lot of very interesting similarities. But yeah, a very terrible story overall.
By the way, I just Googled Jody Hildebrandt and she is serving time.
Yes, she is. Thank God they got her.
Her and Ruby Frank are serving time for pleading guilty to abusing two of Frankie's children in what prosecutors called a concentration camp. Interesting. Okay. Wow. Violet, my head's spinning. It disgust, really.
I'm a little speechless too, but I'm just going to say that considering it sounds like all that you've been through, you sound like you have deconstructed a lot and you sound very articulate. You sound like you've done a lot of healing to be able to talk about it in the way that you do without literally breaking down emotionally.
Yes.
I'm definitely a little desensitized, I think, but I have had a lot of time to heal and deconstruct. I've been in therapy since I was about 21, I want to say. So it's been about 7 years. I've been seeing a specialized trauma therapist for the past year. I've had a bit of time to kind of take a step back from everything.
Where are you in your own personal life? Did you ever get married? Do you have children?
I ended up getting married when I was 20 years old. We ended up getting divorced a few years later. Right now, I live with my boyfriend. We just made 3 years. I have a job and I wear pants. And I'm doing really good. I have a lot of struggles, of course, as one does, considering. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the biggest victories that I've been having recently is learning how to socialize with people without being very paranoid.
Of course.
No, it's really good. Like, I feel like I'm finally settling in and just kind of able to, you know, just live my life however I want to. And it turns out I want to have like a really nice, chill life. So
which you deserve, which you absolutely deserve.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Yeah, I definitely, I like to talk about the stuff I went through and about the mindsets and everything behind it, because I cannot express again how dangerous my mindset was when I was in my mid to late teen years. I was very violent. I was very okay with the concept of violence and torture, things like that. And I think that it's really important for somebody that's come out of that to try to help folks understand how to help people that they know that are in that mindset still. You know, it's very easy to demonize somebody who thinks like that and be like, oh, burn them all and whatnot. They are still people and they still do need help. And it's hard to really understand why they're like that. And I think just with me having been through that and come out the other side, I think that I can kind of just give a little bit of insight to people.
Well, you're doing that on TikTok, from what I understand. Are you thinking of doing any books? Or I understand you're starting to do like podcasts, doing the podcast circuit, and you're getting the word out there, which is great. And I'm not one to capitalize on trauma, so somebody else's trauma, but it sounds like you have a very good book or movie in there that, but I don't know if that's something that you want to just leave behind.
I definitely want to write a book. I've always wanted to write since I was a kid. That was like one of the main ways I disassociated from everything, was I would just write stories and just spend hours doing that. And, you know, it turns out I have some stuff that, you know, I think would help people, that people would want to hear. And also, it's really cathartic just to get it out. I have been doing a lot of writing about it lately, and I saved a lot of my journals from back in those days. And that is definitely something that I would like to do. It might be a minute, frankly, though, because I still need to learn the delicate art of not emotionally flooding yourself when you go back to those times in your mind. But again, that's why I'm in trauma therapy, so I can learn how to process things.
Right. Wow.
I'm just curious. Are you doing any EMDR therapy?
I'm not doing EMDR. I considered it, but because the whole Pentecostal influence that really saturated both of the groups that I was involved in, anything that is remotely similar to what they call in the therapy world is trancing. You see it a lot with those like really Pentecostal worship services where they're like swaying, rolling, crying.
Yeah.
Anything that makes me think I'm in that kind of a situation, I freak out.
It triggers you. Sure.
Yeah. I get really upset. So that's something that I talked to my therapist about, and he told me like, yeah, I would not recommend you ever try that kind of therapy. I don't think that's a good idea.
Okay.
Right now I'm doing something called DBT. It's dialectical behavioral therapy.
I'm very familiar with it. Okay.
Yeah. And good. It has been really helpful.
Whatever became of the jacket, the witch or the gothic jacket?
Well, I told people that I destroyed it, but I actually took it across several different towns and left it at a thrift store that I was pretty sure nobody I knew would go to because I couldn't bear to get rid of it. So the witch jacket is somewhere out there. I'm really hoping like a cool little goth teenager found it and was super excited. But last I saw her, she was hanging on the rack at a thrift store. Mm. She's out there somewhere though. Godspeed.
Well, wow. Violet, do you have any words of wisdom for like any for like cult survivors and or anybody who might be thinking about joining a group that they might be questioning? What would be your words of advice or your words of wisdom?
I would really encourage anybody who's looking at a religious group to see how the group feels. First step, right off the bat, see how they feel about you attending semi-regularly, but not committing to the group. Because that's something that I've noticed with a lot of these high-control religions is they tend to demand fealty very quickly. I know that's kind of an odd thing to go for, to use to filter out these groups, but that's something that I see almost every single time. And it's really easy to do that because they tend to love bomb you. Watch out if you feel like it's too much of a perfect fit. Again, people that love bomb as a career, you know, people that campaign for these cults, they're really good at just intuitively knowing the specific broken parts of you. Not that anybody's broken. I should rephrase that. The parts where you struggle.
You're vulnerable. The vulnerable parts.
Yeah, they smell blood in the water.
Yep.
So, you know, just
good analogy.
Somebody that seems too much of a perfect fit, like just don't distrust anybody you vibe with, but really like let a little bit of time sit for sure. Research the bite model. That's what they use to define what is a cult, a high control religion group. But again, like it's really hard to see that when you're walking into the group. It's hard to hold that bite model up when they're in the love bombing phase, but keep in mind what that is and watch for any of those things starting to happen when you're there.
Okay, so I'm going to piggyback off of Melody's question. So what she basically said is if somebody's thinking of joining a religious organization and you answered that very brilliantly. But you, as a child at the age of 2, 3, or 4, were brought up in this death cult. And what you went through from the ages of 5 to 8, okay. What's interesting about this cult and or your experience, it happened in modern day where people can Google or listen to podcasts or listen to YouTube. So, you know, we've interviewed people who had experiences back in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s where there was no social media. There was so I think my question is, what advice would you give to somebody who's maybe 12, 13, 14, 15, teenager, and they're in this cult or religious group and they no longer want to be in it? Who can they go to like what you did? You did a smart thing. You went to this neighbor or this woman down the block because you knew your mom didn't have your best interest. So you went to this woman, even though you know she might be a little loopy, but I think she saved you, right? In a sense.
She did. She was very damaging in her own way, but at the time, it was exactly what I needed.
What you needed. So to somebody who might be listening with their earbuds behind the library some way, I don't know, and they find themselves in a very similar situation that you were in, what would you advise to them?
I think my biggest piece of advice would be information cannot hurt you. Your religious beliefs, you might feel very passionately about them. You might want to, you know, adhere to a lot of the beliefs that people in your group share, but it will not change your mind or make you evil to learn other things. You don't have to commit to becoming a Satanist to just read somebody else's doctrine or read somebody criticizing your specific theology. Information cannot hurt you. You right. are smart enough to decide what you do and don't want to believe. Just get yourself exposed to different points of view. It doesn't make you somebody who is backsliding and agreeing with it. Because that's a huge thing. It's like if you get exposed to, you know, this liberal belief system or, you know, whatever, it's going to make you a bad person. You'll be backsliding and you'll turn evil. You know, you're not going to do that. You're not evil for just learning about how different people live and different belief systems. Don't be afraid to do that. That would be my advice for somebody who has some kind of unorthodox beliefs, a little more extreme than the average person, but feels uncomfortable. It's not going to hurt you to learn. Just learn. You're not signing your soul away.
I think that's excellent advice.
Yeah, and something that for me was a huge deal when I was first starting to deconstruct was listening to stories from other people from similar groups who had deconstructed, because there's a lot of very complicated layers of feelings that you feel really isolated and you don't know how to express that. You don't know if anybody feels the same way you do. You start feeling crazy. People like the Preacher Boys. And then there's like another group. Her name is Sadie. She does a podcast as well. She was from the IBLP, IFB-IBLP kind of situation. But listening to people like that, or people on Reddit, or just people in random places talking about their experiences and their thought processes in real time, it really can help you get your feet under you. And help with the isolation, because the isolation is really hard to deal with if you're starting your deconstruction, because your group is your entire world. And when you walk away from that, you have nothing. You've been taught to be afraid of everybody else, and your entire world could very likely turn on you if they think you're asking questions, and it's really hard. So feeling a little bit of connection, camaraderie, just knowing there's other people that have been through something similar can really help someone maneuver this really scary world of stepping back from an extreme religious group.
Very well put. And luckily we have, they, if those who might be listening, who might be in your shoes, they have today, like you mentioned Reddit. So yes, there's a lot of resources out there.
So I'm going to assume that basically this is why you do what you do on social media, is to provide that knowledge and information to other people. And that must be part of your healing process, is helping others through your healing journey to share how you've done it and how you've processed it and putting it out there for other people to find and view and to help them. And I think that's amazing. I love that.
Thank you. Yeah, I really, that was the biggest thing for me. And when I first started deconstructing, it wasn't a huge topic. It wasn't really talked about a lot. There were very limited resources that I could find, even though I had access to the internet. And now a lot of people are talking about things, and I think that's really good. And I want to make the way easier for folks coming out behind me. You know, it's so much easier to walk along if there's footprints ahead of you.
Absolutely.
I want to pass on that gift that those Redditors 10 years ago gave me, writing in their message board that's, you know, somewhere out in cyberspace. They gave me such a big gift. I want to pass that on to other people.
Okay, Violet. So in wrapping up, where can we find you on social media?
Well, currently I have my TikTok account. Let me just pull it up so I can read off the exact handle. But
and
yeah,
we will put that in the show notes too, just so you know.
Thank you. It's a Violet_Villainous. And I also just set up an account on Blue Sky. I'm trying to get set up with Instagram, but I weirdly got banned for not sure why. But
seriously?
Yeah, like I set it up and immediately after the account was set up, it banned it. I'm not sure what happened there, but I do also have an account on Blue Sky. It's Violet-Villainous. That's me. Yeah, come find me. Say hi.
And are you on Facebook?
I am not on Facebook, no.
Okay. All right.
I try really hard to keep my personal account separated from my advocacy accounts because I have unfortunately gotten some very frightening messages sent to me. So I would like to make sure that my family is
safe. You know. Yeah, understandable. Absolutely. Yeah.
We appreciate that.
Yeah, we absolutely appreciate that. On TikTok, you're Violet_Villainous. And so we're going to direct people to go there. I'll follow you. And are we following her?
Yes.
Melody?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, Violet. Thank you. I cannot express the sincere thanks for you to come on and share
so much trauma.
It made me speechless. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm not used to the whole podcast thing yet, so I might have been a little disjointed, but I really appreciate you guys having me on.
No, you did great. You did absolutely great. So
thank you. And thank you guys for everything that you're doing for survivors. I appreciate so much the platform that you're giving folks. It's wonderful. I'm so happy to see it. It really touches my heart to know that people like you are doing this kind of thing.
And if you ever do write a book or start to or do something else, please come back. Let us know. We'll have you back on.
I will absolutely do that.
Okay, Violet. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you. Thank you.
And once again, we want to thank Violet so much for having the bravery to come on and share her traumatic story with all of us. I just appreciate her and her advocacy and the work that she's doing to help other survivors out there. And I took a couple notes here. I'm going to just, for the audience's sake, I'm going to go over what the BITE model is for anybody who does not know. It is a metric used by cult experts, created by Stephen Hussan, I think his name is, if I have his name right. If I don't have his name right, I apologize for that. But it stands for BITE, the authoritarian control. The B is for if they try to control your behavior. The I is for information. The T is for thought. And the E is for emotion. It's the different ways in which a cult will try to control your life. So, and I know she brought up the BITE model, but we didn't go into what that means. So for anybody listening that might want some more clarification
on
that.
I think we've covered that in the past,
but we have.
She did mention it. All right. So I'm just going to say right off the bat, I'm speechless. To the audience, and I told this after we recorded that, I didn't see that coming. So, you know, how we work is that we get our guests, we get them booked, and Melody will pre-screen them and get their story and get the cult that they were involved in, and then she'll look it up and she does her research. I just wasn't prepared for what I heard. As she was telling us about the assaults in that other cabin and being filmed and her father, my stomach was just literally churning. And
Yeah.
But like
that's
you said,
probably the hardest part of her story, I would guess.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
Even
with all the other trauma, that just takes the cake, right?
Yeah. But as you said and you mentioned, she sounds wonderful. Like she's struggling. But the fact that she's able to come on and talk about that and she's doing advocacy work, Violet, you are amazing. That's all
hats
I can say.
Hats off to her.
Hats off. And I'm just going to keep the rest to myself because, going to keep the rest of it. Well, no, nothing. Yeah, I'm just. There's just some things I'd like to say about. But I'm.
I'll just drop a little thing here. I'll just help you. Hang them high. That's all I'll say, Andrew. We'll just say that.
Thank you. That's where I was going. That's exactly where I was going.
So that we'll just leave it that simple. That simple little term there. The other thing I did want to touch on, a couple other things actually that I wanted to touch on that she brought up, was the overcommitting too quickly, which I thought was really good advice and not advice that we typically get from a lot of survivors, but it actually is very similar to advice that you would give somebody in a relationship too, right? Somebody who wants you to overly commit and be overly or almost controlling too quickly in a relationship to where you're like, this seems a little suspicious. That usually means that something is wrong. If they can't, they think, well, you have to be here every Saturday or every Sunday or whatever wherever they keep the Sabbath or something, and think that you have to be committed right away and just want to suck you in. That's usually a red flag.
And we've said this many, many, many times. Cults and relationships can be very much similar. Unhealthy ones. Let's just say unhealthy relationships. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And the other thing I wanted to mention, too, when she was talking about was the support groups. Support groups are out there, too. The social media support groups, all of those things are very helpful for the survivors. And certainly Violet, with her presence on TikTok and her advocacy for other survivors, is part of that community 100%. So it's a wonderful episode as far as she was, like you said, she's just articulate, able to share her story so well. And we just appreciate her sharing the hard parts of that story, because we know that wasn't easy. That can't be easy to share all of that, but she did it.
It wasn't easy to listen to. I can't imagine telling it. Oh,
no,
God.
Absolutely.
So, all right. Once again, thank you, Violet.
Yes, Violet. Thank you again for coming on the show. And as always, we want to thank all of you for tuning into Cultimatum. Your support is always appreciated. And if you enjoyed today's episode, if you could just take a moment to rate and review us on platforms such as Apple and Spotify, it does really help boost our ratings. And and don't forget to follow, share, and keep listening to all of our latest episodes as well.
You can also contact us by joining our Facebook group, Cultimatum Podcast, where we dive deeper into these important topics.
And you can find us on other social media platforms, including Instagram, Pinterest, TikTok, YouTube, and Threads.
If you have a personal experience with cult or human trafficking that you'd like to share, reach out to us at cultimatumpodcast@gmail.com.
And if you are an ex-cult member in need of any additional support, you can consider joining the Cult Escape and Recovery Group on Facebook.
You can also check out, if you want to hear more from me, my other podcast called The Anonymous Andrew Modern Dating Podcast. I could use some more listeners and some reviews. So, and also, if this is the most important part of our podcast, is the cost of running this podcast. We have a little link in the show notes called Buy Us a Cup of Coffee. You click on that and you can donate $5, $10 to the cause, and it will help us keep us going. And now they have a new thing called monthly. I don't think it's a subscription, but I haven't had a chance to look into it, but you could donate each month $5 or $10, whatever. So it's in the show notes. We really could use your support financially. Thank you.
Yes. And as always, stay safe, stay informed, and remember, you are not alone.